writing, though it's a very sedentary thing in a way, but it does require a huge charge of energy. And I need to feel very driven and sort of manic almost, you know. And it's like a marvellous sort of playing. Catching those moments when you get older becomes quite a problem.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. That was the voice of the novelist Barbara Trepido. If this is the first time you've heard of her, then you might be on the verge of discovering a new favourite. Barbara is the author of seven novels, starting with 1982's Brother of the More Famous Jack, a real cult hit about a young woman who falls in with the bohemian family of one of her university lecturers. It was republished last year to mark its 40th anniversary. Her other novels include 1994's Juggling, which she explains in this conversation is her favourite, and 2003's Frankie and Stanky, which is a great fictionalised account of her own childhood growing up white in South Africa under apartheid. It was longlisted for the Booker Prize. People who love Barbara's work really love it, as I discovered when I told people I was interviewing her. When the new edition of Brother of the More Famous Jack came out last year, it was stuffed with quotes from her famous fans like Anne Patchett, Elizabeth Gilbert and Rachel Cusk. So she's been hugely influential. When I had Maggie O'Farrell on the podcast a couple of years ago, she talked about being taught creative writing by Barbara in her early 20s and what an impact that had on her. And Barbara shares her memories of that time in this episode. I went to visit her at home in Oxford in March this year. Her house is packed with bookshelves, and as her son and granddaughter were staying with her, the kitchen table was full of art supplies. You might hear Barbara's dog Kez pattering around in the background of our conversation, as well as rain at one point and birdsong at another when we opened the back door. Her garden goes all the way down to the canal. It was wonderful to meet her, and she told me all about her playful, physical writing process, what it's like trying to summon the energy to write in her 80s, and how Jane Austen may have influenced her approach to dialogue. Before we start, as you know, this season of In Writing is sponsored by the writing school Curtis Brown Creative, which is associated with the literary and talent agency Curtis Brown. Since the school launched in 2011, over 180 students have gone on to get major book deals. That includes the critically acclaimed authors Bonnie Garmus, Jane Harper, and Julia Armfield. Whatever stage you're at with your writing, Curtis Brown Creative has an online course that can help you. If you're looking to get your novel off the ground, you might want to try the 6-week Starting to Write Your Novel course, led by author and founder of Curtis Brown Creative, Anna Davis. Or you can join a 6-week course focused on a specific genre, like historical fiction, science fiction, psychological thrillers, crime, romance, or young adult. The good news is that there's an exclusive discount for In Writing listeners. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of Starting to Write Your Novel or any other 6-week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. I will be back at the end of the episode with some other bits of info, but for now, over to Barbara, who started by telling me about the glass-roofed kitchen where she does her writing.
Well, this is basically a little bit of an extension to a little two-up, two-down workman's terrace house in central North Oxford. And so it's got lots of glass, which I was told when I bought it was treble glazed, but nonetheless it gets very cold in winter and hot in summer. But it is very light, which is great because I'm really allergic to dark houses. We're sitting at the kitchen table, which is currently taken over by fibre pens and piles of books that occasionally I shift from the table to the floor to the bookcase, but we always breed more of them. And out of there are kind of glass French windows onto a brick terrace, which badly needs scrubbing. And beyond that is a little garden that fronts onto the Oxford Canal.
And some really beautiful art on the wall behind you.
Oh, yes. Well, most of it's my son's GCSE artwork.
Is it? What a talent.
Except for a lovely friend I had, Bridget John, who came from a line of distinguished English painters and painted that nice little oil painting of the table with the flowers and the pears.
It's got a lovely feel to it, this room. And this is where you write sometimes?
Yes, I get up at about 4 o'clock in the morning and make coffee. And I discovered after I wrote my first novel, where I used to wait for everyone to go to bed and then start writing at midnight and go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and feel like death next day, I discovered by accident that waking at 4 o'clock in the morning and writing until breakfast time was wonderful, partly because if you're quite gregarious, you can't kind of start visiting cafes or phoning your friends, and the world just entirely belongs to you. And the world real life doesn't impinge. So what you're writing, and I never write in a bland sort of way, you know, I just sort of muddle about staring into the dark. And so it's much easier to get into that side of your brain, at 4 o'clock in the morning when you're still almost in a dream state.
That's really interesting, yeah. So you're not sort of, it's before the world has kind of crept into your thoughts and taken over. You can just be more imaginative.
Yes. And it's a real treat to be, just to have the world to yourself and be interacting with the whole cast of pretend people.
Yes. And you said you're working on or thinking about, or a bit of both, another book, a sequel to Brother of the More Famous Jack.
Yes, I've been terribly dawdly, I must say. And I have discovered with shock that what you don't write in when you're younger is the fact that you're energy levels reduce so dramatically. I once helped an elderly woman with her cases at Oxford Station when I think I'd just turned 70. And she said to me, I waited with her while we waited for her son to come. And she said, now you must enjoy your 70s, my dear. This is the last time that you will feel young. And she's absolutely right, because I now find summoning energy is quite a problem. And writing, though it's a very sedentary thing in a way, but it does require a huge charge of energy.
Yes.
And I need to feel very driven and sort of manic almost, you know, and it's like a marvellous sort of playing. But you need to be feeling quite upbeat and energetic, and catching those moments when you get older becomes quite a problem.
Yeah, and I think it's when you're deep in concentration working on something for several hours, I always feel completely exhausted afterwards, even if I haven't sort of left my flat all day and all I've done is sit at the computer working. I feel completely drained by that.
Yes, though it is a nice feeling when you think, even if you're not very well and your body's feeling decrepit, that your mind keeps on working, you know, on those occasions where you feel ghastly because you've only had 2 hours sleep and you're feeling almost dizzy, but your brain is quite energetic.
So what's your, have you worked out a way around this? I mean, what if you just did an hour a day or something? Would that be...
I'm terribly undisciplined, you know. I'm always very threatened by people who say I sit down at 8 o'clock and I write 2,000 words and blah, blah, because I write when I feel like it, you know, or when I, the urge grabs me so that I can't not do it. But I'm not disciplined enough to make myself do it unless I'm well into it, and then it, the momentum is there.
Yes. I think as well, it's not the most energetic time of year, this. I mean, you may feel a bit more up for it when it's a bit warmer and lighter.
Yes, only trouble is the moment the nice weather starts, then I get a whole string of allergies.
Oh, no.
So I'm the person that's always very grateful when it rains in May and April.
When do you remember first being interested in writing?
Well, you know, when I wrote my first novel and I knew nothing about publishing and I just shoved the whole thing in an envelope and sent it to a publisher, and I started getting asked about, you know, what else I'd written, and I thought, well, I haven't written anything, and nobody would quite believe me. And then I did start remembering that I endlessly wrote stories as a small child, and actually, I suppose, in my teenage years, I tended to write stories for neighbours' children. But when I was a tiny girl, in fact, my mother started sending me this stuff, little books I'd written for her. Because, I don't know, I always felt wrong-footed and I was always sort of saying sorry to her.
Oh.
And writing her these little stories to appease her. But, you know, I was never very motivated, so I suppose I just wasted a lot of talent.
Well, so how did you published Brother of the More Famous Jack when you were, that came out when you were 40, is that right? I think it is.
Yes, probably just over 40.
And how did
41? It came out in 1982, and I was, I think, 41.
Yeah.
When it was actually published. Though, you know, because it was a first novel, I could just dawdle over it as long as I liked. So I started writing it, and then I put it away in a box, and I had babies, and then I fished it out again, sort of egged on by a woman I met at the preschool playgroup, because we'd moved to Oxford by then, and, you know, you get a very sort of educated class of mothers who you meet, and one of the mothers who brought her little boy to play with my little boy, who was a medical historian, was having coffee with me, and she said, oh, I've written a short story. Can I show it to you? So she showed it to me, and I'd almost forgotten about the rudiments of my book I started writing. And what I thought was, gosh, I write much better dialogue than this. And I said, you know, I started writing something as well. So she said, oh, show me. So I fished it out of a box. And she said, but I love it. You must go on. Just keep writing it. Write it for me. So I sort of wrote it as a serial for her. I didn't think, is it a novel or can I get it published or anything like that?
But something prompted you to sit down and start writing it in the first
place.
Well,
once I got back into writing it, I just couldn't not write it. And I wrote it late at night. And at the time, my husband had lots of graduate students who tended to hang about. You know, we were very open house and they hung about and they ate bowls of spaghetti with us. And by the time everybody finally left or went to bed and I'd got kids to bed, it was quite late. And once I started writing it, it was just completely compelling. I couldn't stop. And it's quite troubling when you think, actually, I like the company of these pretend people more than the people in my real life. I was completely addicted to them. And so I kept inventing more things to do with them. You know, I thought, well, they can go to the cinema, or today they can go to the beach. And after a while, I began to realise that it had some sort of shape, and that to compensate for the fact that it was so picaresque, there were sort of strands of imagery that linked it together. There was Roger's travelling bag and the Monteverdi madrigal and various threads that ran through it. And I thought, you know, I did it all intuitively, but I thought I obviously did that to give it a kind of continuity.
Yes.
And then every now and again, I sat back and I thought, now, what is going to happen to these people? And is it a novel? And
did you feel when, I suppose I'm projecting a bit because I'm almost 40 and I've my first book, All Being Well, will come out next year.
Oh, wow.
And which is exciting. But I wondered, you know, at that point in your life, at this point in your life, did you feel, I wish I'd started earlier publishing books, or did you feel that actually that's a bit of a false sense of urgency? I mean, you've published 7 novels, so it's not as though you'd kind of missed the boat. But I think there is often a lot of pressure on writers to be one of the top writers under 30 or, you know, all this nonsense?
You know, I've never been directed or ambitious. I mean, I like to feel that what I've written is good. And it's fun to get recognition. But no, I remember way back reading a book, an American writer, I think she was called Lisa Alter, and it began with a woman returning home on her 40th birthday. She was on a plane and she was thinking, what would I like to be when I grow up? And I thought, that's me, really. I was vaguely aware when I was at university that the men who were brainy had started thinking about careers and applying for scholarships and fellowships. And I actually heard one of them say, the only person in this class who's serious competition for me is Barbara Scudamore, which was my name at the time. And she's too dozy to get anywhere in life. And even that didn't sort of shake me.
You did things at your own pace.
Yes. And so I wrote that first book to entertain myself and my friend, and because it was addictive and I couldn't, it was only once I'd done it, I thought, hey, is it a novel? And maybe I could get it published.
And then Noah's Ark came out a couple of years
later. Well, you see, once I published that first novel, and if you publish a novel and it gets good reviews and then agents start knocking on your door and publishers start saying, oh, you know, you must write another one within 2 years or everyone will forget about you. And at the time I thought, well, they'll just have to forget about me because, you know, I had little kids and a family and I was feeding the 5,000. But I did sort of feel some pressure from this editor to write another book rather quickly. So I suppose that's the only book I'm a little bit uncomfortable with, because I think the heroine is quite a lot like me, and everything else I've written, other than Frankie and Stanky, which is a memoir and everything just tells the literal truth, but everything else is about completely made up people. Mm. And I find, you know, I've occasionally borrowed people from life just to shift a scene or, you know, in a very minor way, but it doesn't really work. I find people borrowed from real life just stay two-dimensional. Mm. And the ones that
you have to create them
come
yourself
out of the back of your brain. And maybe they're all versions of oneself, regardless of gender, I don't know. But, well, I was in a strange situation as well, because my first novel got published by Gallants, you know, who were not a particularly good fiction publisher at the time, but I didn't know one publisher was different from another. But I did like the editor. And then she left once she'd seen that book through. Mm. And someone else took over who was, I think she was quite depressed and low-key, and quite a few writers just became, sort of gave up writing and got quite depressed, I think.
Oh, no.
Under her, as her charges. And it was only when she said Gallants was being bought by an American publisher, and she said, oh, I'm afraid I can't tell you who it is, when I'd begun my third novel. Because until then, I just thought, well, you stay loyal to your publisher regardless, and I hadn't thought of moving. But at that point, I had actually got an agent, because agents started saying, can I represent you? And she said, you're a bit crazy to stay there.
Was that good advice, do you think?
It was good advice, but I only realised afterwards that she was edging me towards a friend of hers who was editor-in-chief at Michael Joseph. And again, I didn't realise that Michael Joseph was, you know, a very successful sort of middle-brow publisher of successful commercial fiction.
Yes.
So I thought she was very forceful, this woman, and she was completely putting me in the wrong box. I mean, I'm grateful to her because she spent fortunes carting me around the country and organising publishers' dinners for me. But I sort of felt, I'm not really in the same box as Miss Rush of Thrush Green. And then I had the good fortune to meet Alexandra Pringle. She was at Hamish Hamilton, and she published Juggling, and it was transforming. The whole experience of being published by someone who really resonated with what you were doing
really
is marvellous, because until then I thought I didn't really have an editor who could tell the difference between me and, you know, Janet Daly or somebody. You know, I think all writers are part of the same trade union and we should support each other, but, you know, there are writers with whom you feel very in tune.
Yes.
And others where you don't.
Yes, and editor, I think it's a relationship where you want to feel that the editor sees the book the same way that you see it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I read a piece about your work. It was a really glowing, I mean, they're all glowing, to be honest, but it was a very glowing piece. But the writer said that many of your books are essentially romantic comedies, and then they quickly said, but very literary romantic comedies, much more like Pride and Prejudice rather than Bridget Jones's Diary, which made me laugh because I thought, poor Helen Fielding, you know. But also people, you know, if you call something romantic or funny, I think people get a bit anxious that it might be lowbrow or, you know, not, you know, it's hard for people somehow to see it as intelligent, which I think is silly. And how do you feel about all of that?
I've always been quite embarrassed the way nearly all female novelists say Jane Austen is their inspiration. It seems such a cliche. But I suppose that sort of... I think I got some things from her in that, you know, there's a very sharp undercurrent in Jane Austen, isn't there?
Yes.
In fact, you can read Pride and Prejudice as a terribly sad book. I mean, here are these five girls who are going to be homeless and indigent unless they make suitable marriages, that the law is against them. The best Lizzie can hope for is marrying this idiotic, obsequious clergyman. There's nothing to do other than become a governess, or, as what happened to Jane Austen herself and her sister, become kind of impoverished hangers-on in your brother's households, always seated at the end of the table and last to be thought of. You know, the poor relation. It's absolutely ignominious. And at the same time, what I love is the way it's so energetic and so condensed that... when I wrote my first novel, a friend of mine said, you don't waste much time on the scenery, do you? And I thought about that, and I thought, no, I just sort of bounce into the dialogue on the whole. And I thought, that might well be unconsciously from Jane Austen, who doesn't bother much with scenery. Admittedly, there's the Box Hill picnic, but it's all, you know. My dear, said his good lady to him one day. The dialogue is sort of like dancing, isn't it? It's absolutely perfect. It's epigrammatic. It's much more condensed and sparky than the way people actually speak. But nonetheless, it comes across. And the romantic thing is, I mean, it's pure wish fulfillment, isn't it? I mean, a girl like Lizzie Bennet would never get to marry Mr. Darcy. But nonetheless, he sort of stays in people's minds as a wish fulfillment hero. And I only realised after the event that in a much more sort of offbeat way, Jonathan Goldman is clearly a wish fulfillment man. You know, the man who will have dominating sexual fantasies while he's ironing your Viola shirts and that sort of thing. He does all the cooking. He manages to be hunky and also quite sort of feminist.
You write in a wonderfully sort of almost conversational way. And I feel when I'm reading your work as though you're telling me the story sort of across the table. And I think it is very energetic, and your dialogue is very strong. Do you think your voice sort of came out fully formed, or did it take you a while to work out who you were as a writer?
It's an interesting thing that all sorts of really talented people just never managed to find a voice, once my first novel came out, so many people said, you know, I've written a short story, can I show it to you? And, you know, academics and people, I thought, and I was so sort of humble, I thought, well, if I can write a novel, then anyone can. And I started writing the dreadful stuff people write. And I thought, it's just that you haven't hit upon how to tell your story. And I remember reading Evelyn Waugh in a letter to Nancy Mitford saying that he said women writers, because they don't go to school and learn Latin and Greek, they just write as if they were chatting to their friends over the telephone. And I think he meant it to be down-putting, but I thought, well, good for them. It's what makes their, you know, Nancy Mitford so page-turning. And I hadn't actually read Nancy Mitford until after I wrote my first novel. It's just that people said the book reminded them of The Pursuit of Love, and which is the funniest book ever, actually, isn't
it?
And that's quite right what you say, because, well, I do a lot of talking out loud, you know, which is another advantage of it being 4 o'clock in the morning, because nobody's listening to you. And I do a lot of shouting into the mirror and crying and, you know, and I move around, I move the furniture and
really?
I sit in different chairs if I'm doing a conversation. And I like to, you know, if people are around a dinner table, I need to know where they're sitting. I noticed there's a book of Carol Shields's where she actually puts the dining table plan in the book. There's a sketch of, you know, the table and where people are sitting. And I think, well, I make those sketches, I just haven't thought to put them in the book. But yeah, so I do quite a lot of walking around and talking into the mirror, and I read everything out loud over and over again.
I do that as well.
Do you?
Because I think...
And I know Michael Dibden said to me when I told him, he said, but books aren't meant to be read aloud. Why do you bother? You know, people read them quietly, but...
You catch all sorts of things when you read it aloud that don't...
You find out what's wrong with it, don't you? Immediately you think, oh, ouch, you know, that rhythm is wrong, or...
Yeah.
That sentence is three times. Yes. And you think, I've reread this 10 times and I'm still catching things that are a bit awkward.
Yeah.
And then you marvel at someone like Dickens who just turned it out unedited.
I had Maggie O'Farrell on this podcast a couple of years ago. And I was listening back to it for some reason recently. And she talked about you. She said that... in her early 20s, she did a novel writing course at the Arvon Foundation.
Oh, yes.
And she was taught by you and Elspeth Barker. And she said that the encouragement that the two of you gave her was a sort of a key moment in her becoming a novelist. So thanks for that on behalf of people who enjoy Maggie O'Farrell's novels. I wondered whether teaching writing has been useful for you as well, whether you've got things from doing that, working with writers.
I wouldn't have thought so, because I never thought that you could actually teach writing. And I went and bought some of these books about teaching writing, and I thought all of them were hopeless and useless. I couldn't relate to them anyway, you know. Have you ever thought of finding names for your characters in graveyards or the telephone directory? And I thought, well, my characters always have their names. They might be quite cross if I try to change their names, you know. I was good at doing these sort of workshop sessions, and, you know, people would come along with a whole mound of stuff, and they which they clearly disliked. You know, I don't like my novel, but I've got to write it. And I tried to make people see that it wasn't compulsory. You know, you didn't have to write a novel. The only one of the books that I read about writing that resonated at all for me was one written by Michelle Roberts, I think, who'd run a writing class that I think Esther Freud had gone to in her youth. She had some ideas but the one I remember that I borrowed from, and then afterwards I just managed to make up lots for myself, but writing a short story in half an hour, and you produce a whole lot of cards of different colours with a character a scene, a dilemma and a conclusion. And on the character's card, you just write anything that comes into your head. Opera singer, school teacher, lost child, dentist. Yeah. And then you have a situation like lost theatre ticket or missed plane or etc. And then you make a context, you know, like a theatre, a park, an airport, whatever comes into your head. And then a situation like, you know, despair, resolution, reconciliation, etc. And then I always did the exercises in the class with the students, because that way you find out how easy or how hard it is. And people would say, oh, I love my opera singer. I'm sick of my novel. I'm going to write about the opera singer instead, and so on. And when people think this is just playing, it isn't my novel, then, you know, the writing starts to get up and dance, and that's what you want. You don't want it to be kind of dead on the page.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that I inspired anything, I did that, but not for Maggie, because Maggie was already writing her book, and she just wanted every minute to sit in one of those monkish little cells they had and write. But she did spend long hours talking to me and Elspeth and showing us what she'd written. Mm. And so actually I phoned my editor and my agent from Arvon and said, we've got this young woman here who, you know, just writes like a dream, and the novel she's writing is completely crazy, but she's not only going to finish this book, but she's going to write lots more, and you should have her. And Alexandra at that time was just moving from being an agent to taking up at Bloomsbury, and she felt it wouldn't be ethical to take her on. So she handed her over to the young woman who's now my agent, who took Maggie on and is still Maggie's agent, and passed Maggie on to the person she had worked with at Hamish Hamilton, who then sadly died, who worked on that novel, you know, because all the bones of a great story were there, but it had some very unlikely elements, and so it was reshaped quite considerably. But
she said, she talked about that on the podcast, and she said that she you know, she really had to work on it a lot, but she said she felt that that was almost a test in a way to, you know, perhaps for her agent to confirm that she was willing to put the work in.
Yeah,
you know.
And it did terribly well. And she's got a wonderful sort of rather sort of lush, almost Daphne du Maurier kind of quality about her writing, I think, that
yes,
particularly young women love.
I read a feature about you, another one, where they said her readers hold her in desperate affection. And I thought that's quite right, actually, because everybody I have told that I was doing this interview, if they had read your work, they all responded by going, oh, I love her. Oh, she's one of my favourite novelists. And I thought, you know, has that been one of the great joys of your writing life, that you've found this audience who really have a very deep emotional attachment to you and to what you do?
Well, you know, I've always loved it. When I started getting invited to, you know, speak at literature festivals or in bookshops and so on, I really loved that contact, and I like talking about my stuff and meeting people afterwards. You know, I stopped doing that when my husband had a stroke, and I never really, I've become rather invisible, I think, in that respect. Though Alexandra Pringle has been miraculous in bringing my name to the fore again last year by republishing Jack.
Yeah.
So I'm hugely grateful to her, and I'll never be able to repay her for all that she's done.
I'm sure she doesn't see it that way. But is there anything you find particularly challenging as a writer?
What I find most difficult is, you know, I'll stare into the dark and I have these characters and they start talking and I hear their voices and I see them sort of in silhouette. I see how they move. But they're a bit like characters in dreams, you know. You don't see them all that clearly until one day you meet someone in the street or you see and you think, now I know what Arnie looked like. And I noticed Jane Austen says in a letter to her sister that she had just found Caroline Bingley in the National Portrait Gallery. And I thought she also had that problem that she didn't clearly see the characters' faces until she saw this picture in the National Portrait Gallery. She said, no, that's Caroline Bingley. So, yes, I have these characters and I know exactly how they sound and how they speak, and so that's not a problem. And I love doing dialogue, though I do write and rewrite, but mainly that's just to make it more...
Tighter,
yes. And in a way it takes longer and it's more... I don't know if you find that writing the sort of narrative sequences is easier. Well, it's like making music with only one instrument, but when you've got... And then also because I'm very obsessed with music and I get frustrated when, you know, you hear people in an opera, particularly Mozart operas, where you get 3-4 people singing at once and they're singing different tunes, but they're in harmony. I so want to get that effect of 2 people talking at the same time and you can't quite do it. So I had a pair of twins who got separated at birth, which is... a sort of Shakespearean cliche. And when they re-meet, that one is a young Frenchman, and the other is English, because the mothers returned to France with one of the twins and the other stayed in England. And they do the same things at the same time, so they bump into each other because they make the same gestures or they get stuck in a rotating door together. And they speak at the same time, but what they say... The one says it in French and the other says it in English. And so I tried that, you know, writing the 2 sentences and pairing them. And that's the nearest that I could get to, yes, to make music. Plotting. I've never really done plotting. And I know for some people, plotting is very important and they plot the whole thing very carefully. John Bowlby once said he divided writers into... wizards and muddlers. And I thought, well, I'm definitely a muddler and I know you're despising me for it, but I don't know where I'm going. But when you're deeply into the book, you get given lovely presents, don't you? Suddenly connections, like somebody's birthday is exactly on the right day or even though you haven't planned it.
Do you remember have there been any ingenious pieces of advice that you've received about writing or sort of breakthrough moments that have actually improved your writing over the years? Can you think of anything?
I think I've just discovered them for myself along the way. You know, I occasionally read books that I admire, but then they're usually doing something that's so completely different from me. And I think, I wonder how on earth he does that, or... I couldn't do that. But yes, I noticed some people do kind of consciously have models. When I said to Philip Henshaw once, you know, I just can't write short stories, he said, have you ever tried reading? I can't remember who it was he suggested that I read. And I thought that wouldn't occur to me to read someone as a sort of model or guide. And I've no doubt that I have also, you know, I'm dependent on all sorts of influences.
But less consciously.
But I'm not conscious of any of it. I noticed somebody who wrote something nice about my novel said, you know when a novel's good, when you want to steal all of it. And I thought, I've never thought of stealing something or thinking, oh, that's a good idea, I must try that.
When you look back on your writing life, what do you feel the most proud of?
I suppose if I had to pick one, I like juggling best. To tell you the truth, you know, I occasionally reread all my books and I enjoy them. And I think, you know, that's an uplifting experience. That's nice and they make me laugh or cry. You know, once I was talking at the Edinburgh Festival and Anne Fine said... I think I'd only written 2 books then, and she said she was once married to an Oxford fellow, you know, and she said, I'll tell you why your heroines are such shrinking violets, I can't remember the words she used, is because you live in Oxford where all the men are so opinionated and bossy, and I thought, she's right that my heroines do sort of let other people push them around in a way. And that's me. I've always let everyone sort of push me around. And you know, I'm not clear about what I want and I don't go for it. But I thought, no, she's not right about the Oxford thing. It's, you know, obviously something that is set much earlier, in early childhood probably. You know, I had a rather dominating father and a shrinking violet mother. And I imagine that's what's far more important. And then I took that to heart. And so when I started writing that trilogy of novels, Temples of Delight, Juggling and the Travelling Horn Player, Christina was this feisty, forceful, edgy child who, you know, was difficult and refused to bow to authority, and in Juggling actually runs away. And I thought, I really like this girl, you know, I found her inspiring, and maybe it made me become a bit more pushy in my own life, though I doubt it.
Huge thank you to Barbara Trepido, who made me feel so welcome in Oxford and was so wonderful to speak to. As always, I've got various links to put in the episode notes, including to Barbara's novels, which you can browse in the In Writing bookshop. Also the Maggie O'Farrell episode, where Maggie credits Barbara with helping her to become a novelist. If you'd like to receive my newsletter on the writing process, I would love you to sign up. It's at inwriting.substack.com. And I also do live silent writing sessions on Google Meet with subscribers a couple of times a month. So do visit the Substack to find out more about that. If you're enjoying the podcast, I would be delighted if you would share it on social media or send it to a friend who might like it or review it on Apple Podcasts. All of that really helps me to keep going and make more episodes. A reminder before we go of my exclusive discount code for Curtis Brown Creative's short online writing courses. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. There's only one episode left this season, but it's a really lovely one with a writer who's a bit of a national treasure here in the UK. I'm looking forward to sharing that with you next week. Bye for now.